Welcome to Something to Drink About. My name is Alex Van Amberg. I'm a certified sommelier with the Court of Master Sommeliers and a certified specialist of wine with the Society of Wine Educators.
And my name is Christy Van Amberg, and I'm a yoga mom.
And this is kind of a special episode, and I wish it was for a good reason, but in fact, it's for a very infuriating reason. Today, October 29th, the New York Times published an article that I don't have all the specifics on. I read through the article a couple of times. My facts may be a little wrong, but the essence of it is approximately 10 women, possibly more, who are in the court reported to the New York Times, took their complaints to the New York Times of sex scandals, of the abuse they were suffering, of the expectations being handed down from certain people, some of the masters in particular, and the fact that they were expected to trade themselves for favors. Appalling. I don't even have words. I am shattered on so many levels with this. And I'm disgusted, and I am ashamed to be part of this court, and it's hard to even begin to fathom just how appalled I am by this. And I'm a certified level. I'm certified, and I'm trying to become an advanced. And so I have been, for lack of a better phrase, drinking the Kool-Aid. I have bought into the whole Court of Master Sommeliers ethos. I believe in service, humble service. I believe in it. I believe that there's a lot of education to be gained. I believe that the specialization is important. I believe that I have revered these masters who have achieved so much. The movie Somme does a very good job of setting them apart and deifying them on several levels. And these are heroes of mine. And to find out these heroes not only have feet of clay, but are actively scumbags, that's a big problem.
So I think it's important to backtrack a little bit, because a lot of people don't know what the Court of Master Sommeliers is and what the structure is. And I think that that is important. I think the structure of the organization is really important in how this abuse was able to fly under the radar, or be, I don't know how you say it, how people could turn away from it or sweep it under the carpet, because of the structure and because of the dominant masculinity in the structure.
Okay, so the Court of Master Sommeliers started in England, and in my mind, it was based on the old guild format, the idea that there was a master and an apprentice. And then later on through the guild format, the master and the apprentice, there was a journeyman category of someone who was not quite a master, but beyond the apprentice. And so the idea of the Court of Master Sommeliers was sort of founded on this premise, the idea that there were people who were so good that they were at a mastery level of this wine education and this service. And the sommelier profession is based on the idea of humble service, the idea that you're there to provide an experience and you're going to educate yourself to an exceptional degree so that when the moment comes, you are ready with the answer, you are ready with the service, you are able to cater an experience for a guest, for a person, to the nth degree, to this exceptional level of preparedness. And your level of knowledge is a vehicle to guide someone through an evening of exceptional dining out, of exceptional hospitality. That's the whole purpose of the court. And the idea that there were these people that were exceptional masters and they were recognized for that, and that other people could enter the court through this apprenticeship of becoming an introductory member, of becoming then a certified member, of someone who's a fledgling, and then someone who's then additionally later added on an advanced level, someone who's now at this journeyman level, and finally reaching mastery, and that mastery would be recognized both financially and with a credibility, and therefore a certain, you know, respect in the community that knows. There's in the same way that all-star athletes or astronauts or people that are at the absolute top of their profession, there is nowhere further up to go. That, to the hospitality world, is what master sommeliers have become. Mm-hmm. And also, more so, ever since the movie Somme came out in 2011 or 2012, in the appeal of that movie, by following these four master sommelier candidates and watching them succeed and fail as they did, humanize the process, but also showed just how exceptional the amount of commitment had to be to achieve this. And it was inspiring. It was inspiring in a way that it hadn't been inspiring since the court's foundation in 1976, because now the court saw a massive influx of people coming in. There's over 12,000 members in the Americas alone who are participating on some form or level. And of all this, there's about less than 200 masters in the Americas. There's a chapter in Europe, there's a chapter in the Americas, and the more people have been into outer space than have achieved the title of Master Sommelier. And that is an exceptional thing, and it does deserve a big amount of respect. But unfortunately, it's also set the court up as a place where abuses have gone unrecognized, undealt with, and have been hidden and brushed under the carpet, and have finally... A light has been shown into a very dark place into this court now by this article. And if you haven't seen it, I'll put a link in to the Instagram thing, to the page. I want you to read this article. I want you to see what these women have to say, because I consider their abuse to be absolutely shameful. And let me add this disclaimer that what has happened is because of several bad people. And... the thing that makes it worse is that several bad people have been behaving in this way, this abusive way, this entitled way, and other people have been, there has to be witnesses to this who have looked the other way.
And that is what I find vital for our times right now, because there are the perpetrators and there are the people that are in denial.
Or... not in denial, but are deliberately not taking a stance because of a threat to a perceived threat to their own safety, their own standard, their own popularity. For some reason, they decided that someone else's abuse was fine, and they chose not to take a stand.
And it's very important to take a stand for somebody who is suffering abuse. And people don't take a stand because... as we know, there's a lot to lose. So I could go on about Harvey Weinstein. I have personal experience with Bikram, where I was in Bikram's 9-week training.
Bikram Chowdhury?
Bikram Chowdhury of Bikram Hot Yoga. He was the first one to really make yoga...
mainstream.
Mainstream, like McDonald's. Branded, and it was great yoga. And when I went to his teacher training and saw the 17, 18, 19-year-old girls brushing and combing his hair as he was lecturing on things that at that point were unintelligible, I would storm into the office and say, "What's wrong?" The office staff there would look at me and they would say, "We love the yoga. We put up with the man." Nobody was there to protect the girls.
And the fact that they had a catchphrase built into the system shows that it was endemic in the system for a while.
For a very long while.
and so, again, there's another system of responsible leadership, of authority, of a person that you're supposed to, that these young acolytes are coming in and supposed to be molding themselves off of. And that person or persons are abusing that authority far beyond just taking your money and not delivering a product, but actual physical abuse.
Well, and let's just be clear here that it was not just Bikram, but it was many of his male teachers, and not all of them, but many of his male teachers I saw being inappropriate. I spoke out, and guess what happened?
Oh, I know what happened. I was there.
I am not a Bikram teacher.
Well, and that is the lone voice in the wilderness. This is why I believe, because this happened 17 years ago. And
With Bikram. It was 2004.
So I think that that's important to recognize that our culture is changing, and that if you were to be in that same situation today, that there is a stronger probability of you being believed. So there's a lot of positive growth that has happened in the last two decades. I feel the Me Too movement has provided a strength and a voice, and I think it's taken things in a very positive direction. However, the fact of the matter is that it's brought a bright light to a lot of very dark places in our yes. society. And the shame of you not being believed then is not relieved. And the abuse that those girls suffered has not been relieved by recent events of coming to light and the ability of change happening. And I suppose that's part of my outrage at this whole thing is that these are teachers. I mean, let's, mm-hmm. you know, and
they're
and,
teachers, they're mentors. And the way you explained to me how the guild works earlier at dinner.
And let's go over that because I think that's important.
I agree.
So, I mean, so let's break this down into like two or three parts. First is let's talk about what the guild of or the Court of Master Sommeliers is. And let's talk about how the Guild of Sommeliers is a separate entity because those are mentioned both in the article and the article does conflate them. And then let's talk about what the article says specifically and how it relates to those topics. And then we'll talk about responses to that. So topic number one, the Court of Master Sommeliers was set up in 1976 or so, primarily by a gentleman named Fred Dame. Fred Dame he kicked around for a while, wasn't sure what he wanted to be. Eventually, he discovered in Wine Spectator magazine the idea that this Court of Master Sommeliers existed in England. And so he went to England, and he did an amazing thing at the time. He passed all three parts of the Master Sommelier exam on his first try. It was an extraordinary achievement. And they didn't know what to do with this American. And they're like, well, I guess here you are. Here's your pin. And he came back to America and he kicked around for a while. And the title wasn't well known of what a sommelier is, let alone a master sommelier. And so Fred Dame built the court. Basically, he convinced people to put money, time, energy into it. And he used an old boy network to do that. He used his personal contacts. He used people he knew to build this, to get the money to do that, to find other wine experts and to have them take the same tests he took. He brought over, you know, you need money to bring over these masters to conduct the test. And he created the kernel of what would become the Court of Master Sommeliers America. And he mentored and fathered this thing for decades. And it really is Fred Dame's baby to create this thing. And then he turned it over to other people. But he's still very much a father figure for the whole thing. And so he created this, the Court of Master Sommeliers America. And originally there wasn't much more to it than there were masters. And the idea is that you train until a master thinks you're ready. And then they stump for you and they say, we think you should try the test. And then you take the test and you pass or you fail after paying the fees. And what they did in the Americas is they started to add a formalization to the process. Suddenly there was training to be had. There was a structure to it a bit. And then you became, you know, you and if you passed the initial thing, you became a certified sommelier, which was, it encompassed all three aspects of intro, certified, and advanced that it has now. And then after you're testing again, you could become a master sommelier, provided you passed. So as the court progressed over time, the whole concept is that it's mentorship. It's the idea that there is a master there. He takes you under his wing. She takes you under their wing. And they give you direction, feedback, training. It's the old apprentice master format. And as you grow, you become better until you're ready to become a master yourself. And it is not a formalized process in that it's like hitting the marks for a PhD where you have to have certain levels of education. It's more a matter of you become a master artist at wine. Different master sommeliers have different specialities they excel at, and certain things they're still incredibly bad at. That's just human. That's the nature of this thing. And now in 2020, the court has become formalized to the point where there is an introductory class being taught by master sommeliers, and you take the class and you test and you reach that level. And that doesn't give you any real credit, but essentially means you've set your feet on the path. Then you train yourself at that point using guideposts they've given you to become a certified sommelier. You take a one-day test of three different parts to achieve that. If you achieve that and there's a low pass rate of usually about 50% or less, then that's a really good thing. Well done. Now you can stop there. You are now a certified sommelier and you can call yourself a sommelier officially with the blessing of the court. You are now at a standard level of education they want to see. But if you want to pursue your education further, the next step is advanced sommelier, and that requires a class to learn what the levels of expectation are and a three-part, two-day test in which you then take the test to learn how to be an advanced master, advanced sommelier. And then finally, you have to be invited to test for master. And if you've seen the movie Somme, It's a multi-day process with extraordinary levels of education and service expected, which is why so few of them pass. It has a pass rate of about 2%. So it takes money, it takes time, it takes dedication, and that's where the court is at these days. So there is a lot of room for abuse in that system, because it still is a huge amount of anticipation that you are going to find a master and ask them to sponsor you and to mentor you. And when you give someone that kind of power over your education, you are, in essence, inviting them to abuse that power. And that is the problem with the system. The Court of Master Sommeliers has not kept up with the times because they have not given themselves regulations, specifications, or protections for their people. It is only in the last few months, with Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement and this article coming out, that the court has instigated a policy where there's an anonymous reporting line where you can finally tell someone you've been abused or had expectations advanced upon you or been raped by a master sommelier without getting repercussions put upon you. That has only happened this year in the last few months. That is way too late. There is no safety for any of the students in this. And it's not something I noticed. I've been in the Court of Master Sommeliers now for 6 years.
Well, let's take that apart.
Mm-hmm.
You are a very tall, very handsome, white man.
And I appreciate the compliment. But yes, let's just stick with tall, white man. There is no reason that I am the perfect candidate for this group because I fit in with the majority of the people in this group. However, except for the fact that now we're focusing on youth and the culture and I'm older. So women have never had a fair shake with this group. Black people have rarely had a fair shake with this group. Being a black woman in this group is, I shrink at the chances.
Does it even exist?
So the court has a lot of responsibilities. If they want to survive as an organization, they need a major house cleaning, a major remodel. And the reason they need this, if they're going to survive, is because while I believe in the mission of the court to create this mastery of humble service, what the article in the New York Times said today was it was telling the story of I believe, 10 or 11 different women and the abuse they suffered and the expectation that they would have sex, that they would essentially let themselves be raped in order to achieve advancement within the court. Now, these are allegations that have been given to a reporter who investigated it and followed it up with the New York Times, which I consider a very credible source. These men and these people suffering with these allegations against them have not been taken to court. They have not taken DNA tests. It's very important for me to state that outright. However,
to say allegedly,
I am not saying that any of these men did anything wrong. I am saying that this article states that, and I find these accounts believable. More to the point, I find the structure and the organization in which such abuse could happen incredibly believable. And I am appalled that I am part of this patriarchal, male-dominated, abuse-ridden system.
And let's just go back to was it 2000? When did you get your certified?
Good question. 2015.
2015. So it was 2014 that you started studying.
I got serious about this. The movie Somme came out in 12. I got serious about it in 2014.
Okay. So what you did every night, and people may not know this, I don't know if we've talked about it in our podcast before, but what you did every single night, we had young children, we had new jobs in a new area, we had just moved, and you would do your job, the day, help me with whatever health issue I was having, and then put the kids to bed, and then at 10 o'clock at night, you would come downstairs and you would study for, I don't know how many hours, until 3 or 4 in the morning.
Typically 3 to 4 hours a night.
And then you would go to bed, wake up, do it all over again. Sometimes on your days off, you got to sleep in, but you were incredibly focused. It was so much work. It was an incredible amount of, I don't want to say sacrifice for us, but an adjustment to accommodate study time and quiet for you and travel and expense and all of that for a very young family. And the day you took your test, it was in Portland, right?
It was in Portland, and I've rarely been so nervous.
And you were the very last one to be called. Could you tell that little story? Because
it's a one day. So I flew to Portland late the night before. I got to my hotel by train at 1 a.m. I had to be at the other hotel, and I could only afford the hotel for one night, where I stayed for one night. So I unpacked my suit and steamed everything, got everything ready, and I napped for about 3 hours before I got up and took a very nervous shower, got dressed, repacked all my stuff, and dragged my roller case with me to the hotel where the training, where the examination was to be held. And I had them hold my suitcase at the front desk, and I was flying back that night. So that day, I took the test in the morning. They sit you down and you have your wines and you have your written test of 40 questions on anything. And you have like an hour and a half to do both all the wines in front of you. I had two. You had to go through the whole grid on those. And it's a written examination. And then you had to do the written part of the test. And I test fast because it's my training is to go through confidently. And so I went through the test. I went through the wines. I reviewed my materials. I was the first one done. I sat there for a minute reflecting that maybe I'd gone too fast. And then finally I had to realize if I entered that questioning zone, it was just going to go badly. So I handed in my paper and I left the room. And I was assigned my time to return for the service portion of the test, which was 4 hours later. So here I am in Portland with 4 hours with nothing to do but sweat.
And call me in a panic.
Call and panic. So I went for a walk and I found a candy store and I bought some treats for my sons. And I had lunch and I considered having a glass of wine or a beer. And I ordered a beer and I could only drink like a third of it. And I was just so anxious. And finally my service exam rolled around. And I'm not alone. There's 60 people, 70 people. 70, 80, I don't know.
Thought there were 100 people.
There was something like 75 or 80 people testing for this thing. I don't remember the exact number. Another gentleman who lives in Spokane was at the exact same test, I found out later. He'd probably know. So let's just say 60 people were all testing for this thing. And they've reorganized the rooms. So we go there and they bring me into the room and the advanced sommelier there assigns me my table. I do my service exam, which is... if you've ever heard of flop sweat. I am cascading sweat under my suit. I'm talking to a master sommelier, the same gentleman who taught me in my introductory class and who I had huge amounts of respect for. I'm trying my best to serve. And of course, the first four questions he asks me, I have no answers for, but it's all about service. So I just lean into my service experience and I get through this test and I walk out of the room and I am confident that I am coming back to test again next year.
And that's what you said.
And
that's you called me and you said, I did it.
I
didn't know some answers.
And keep in mind that so I had to borrow money from a friend of our family to take this test.
I forgot about that.
And the generosity of a friend of mine allowed me to actually go at all. We'd been saving and scrimping, and I was able to get the ticket and the hotel room, but I didn't have the money for the test. And we finally, and so anyway, so we borrowed money. So all this was a huge amount of pressure to succeed or die, and I felt I had just died. And the way and so everyone else now has to go in and do the same test. So it's another few hours of waiting, and I'm sitting in the lobby of the hotel with a lack of anywhere else to go, listening to these other sommeliers talking about things I've never heard of in my self-inflicted studies. And I'm like, just all of it is reinforcing how much I must have failed. So they bring us all back up finally, 6 o'clock at night. And I'm running out of time because my plane leaves in an hour and a half and I have to take the train there. And so I'm sweating the time. I'm sweating my catching my plane. I'm sweating all of this. I know I'm failed. Part of me just wants to leave. And I get up to the room and they hand everyone a glass of kava, and we're all standing around clenching our glasses of kava, and everyone's trying to look confident and people are reeking of their artificial confidence that they've been drinking in the bar. And we're all sweating bullets. And in front of this room are three master sommeliers standing there with little handfuls of pins and envelopes on a table behind them. And they congratulate us all on what a great job we did and how tough the test is. And they give the standard set speech of what, not everyone will pass, but everyone deserves to be proud of themselves. And then they start calling off names. And it's not even in alphabetical order. and my last name starts with a V. So it's like a Ambrose, Julie, and you know, von Rathbun, you know, Francis, and Thomas Becket, and the names are just all over the place. So, and I'm just watching these dwindling supplies of pins coming out of their hand as people come up and accept their certification pin, and they're down to like the last pin. And at that point, I've given up on myself. I'm sitting here, I'm drinking my kava. I'm like, it's okay. I will just tell all these people that I've been telling about this test that I failed, but I learned and I grew, and that's great. And Van Amberg Alex, holy shit, what?
That's what he said. He said, holy shit.
I more or less barked it out loud in shock, which shocked the rest of the room. And so at that point, I went up and I got my pin. And
the last pin. Want to say it was the last one.
And in my paperwork and a handshake. And I passed. I passed. And I got some great notes about what I could do better. And it was exceptional. I'd studied for 5 months since taking my intro class to achieve that. And I was very chuffed. Then I took that information and I went home and I used that information at the restaurant I worked at and managed, and I used it to help build a wine club. I used it to drive my next career as a wine salesman, and I've been using this information for 5 years, and my pride in having that pin to wear, my pride in being a member of this Court of Master Sommeliers, my absolute sense of place and purpose built upon this idea of humble hospitality, the idea that I've been giving back mentorship to other people through online resources. I have been very pleased with this accomplishment in my life because it's given me a renewed sense of purpose. I was an actor for years. I was a stand-up comic. I delivered conduit. I worked at McDonald's. I've done lots of different things, but very few things have centered my existence quite as much as wine education has. And to have the foundation be rotten at the core. To have that heroes, that sense that the people you held as heroes, that you admired for their knowledge, for their acuity, for their intelligence, to be poor human beings. To see other people as not other human beings that deserve their mentorship and their grace, but as victims, as people to serve their needs. I don't understand that mentality. I don't get it. How can you move from a sense of hospitality, humble hospitality, the idea of service? And that's what I loved about the court, the idea that these master sommeliers would come back after achieving this thing and give to more people to help spread the message of this humble hospitality. They were humbling themselves again to do it, but apparently they were not. Apparently some of them were power tripping, and I am ashamed and appalled by that, to be part of that. And I don't want to condemn the entire court. There are 12,000 people in there, and not everyone is a bad person. Lots of them are great people with great ambitions. But how deep does it go? Who knew, and who knew when? And we know from the article that things have been happening that were dealt with internally at the court without revealing it to the membership. The idea that they were trying to preserve the court over protecting their members shames me. And that's what I wanted to talk about today. Normally we talk about wine and we have fun, but I'm a white male in our society, and I have a responsibility that goes far beyond my responsibility to myself. My responsibility, because of my privilege, and I don't care what walk of life you come from, if you're a white male on this planet, you have privilege. I don't walk in fear. I walk in confidence because of the color of my skin and the thing that hangs in my pants, and that's not my fault, but that is my responsibility, because there are people out there in the world, there are women that I know, there are women that I'm married to that are not protected by their gender, that are not protected by their skin color, that suffer every day from discrimination. And to see that happen in a thing that I love, I am appalled. And I am lending my voice to a call with this, that the court needs to clean its house. And it needs to do so publicly, and it needs to do so transparently, and it needs to do so in a way that makes them worthy of their mission. And if they cannot do that, they do not deserve to exist. And that, for me, is important for you as our listeners to know, I do not accept my membership to this body lightly. I worked hard to achieve it. I do not have any pride in that achievement at this point because it has been defamed, smeared, drugged through the mud by a number of people who not only have performed these heinous acts, but have the people that have watched it happen and said nothing. We are better than this. So I apologize if this is not what you were expecting. And trust me, the next podcast will be lighthearted and back on track. And I thank you for listening to this. And I encourage you, if you wanted to be part of the Court of Master Sommeliers and to achieve that accreditation, I will not hold it against you if you continue going forward, but go in with your eyes open. There are other bodies of accreditation, the WSET, the Society of Wine Educators. There are other bodies of accreditation that may or may not have similar problems. These problems are not limited to the court. They are not limited to Bikram Chowdhury. They are endemic in our society, and as members of our society, we have responsibilities to protect those who cannot or do not have the opportunity to protect themselves. So, white men of the world, here's your mission. Do better. Don't cover up for your fellow man. Defend those who cannot defend themselves. Stand up and have a voice. And if you have to make a sacrifice, make that sacrifice proudly. Because other people deserve exactly the same chances that we have, without apology. I came to this lesson late in life, and I'm sorry for that, but I will do everything I can going forward to make up for it. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for your time. Do you have anything to add?
Well, I think tonight we need to sip some scotch. I am trying to bring some lightness to this. I have been a victim of Bikram Chowdhury and of being shamed out of his institution because I had a voice. And it took me 12 years of being shamed and not having a place within the yoga world because I didn't know where to go and I lost my trust until there was a group of women, his lawyer, a female lawyer, gathered a group of women from my particular training year. And for all those years that I felt shamed and outcast and not let into the group because I saw what was going on and I was not going to let a young woman go through that, I lost my train of thought, except it took me that many years before I realized that there was somebody doing something about it. And then it wasn't until this past, I don't know, 6-8 months ago when the Bikram documentary came out. And then all my friends came to me and they were like, oh, I remember you talking about how horrible he was. Because now it's out there.
Well, and that's the thing, is that that's the bravery of these women who have come forward and spoken, is that because there is the probability, not the possibility, the probability, the likelihood that you will not be believed and you will be dissuaded, mansplained, or put down for standing up for yourself.
Or made look crazy. Look at Rose McGowan.
Mm-hmm.
She was a whistleblower and everyone... Ooh, she's crazy. Ooh, keep your mouth shut. Ooh, you're not living by the rules of Hollywood, which you and I both know. And there is massive, massive sexual abuse in Hollywood to children, to men, to women.
Well, and I don't know that we can't change the world overnight, but we can change how we participate in that world.
We can
today.
Change how we use our voice.
And that's huge. And I think that's very important to recognize that we all have a voice. And that voice doesn't have to be the Rose McGowan. That voice doesn't have to be calling up the New York Times. That voice can be simply standing up in your workplace. If you work at McDonald's and your boss is putting down your black coworker for being black, don't put up with that. Don't stand by and watch that happen. Stand up, stand with, stand together. There is, it takes courage. But whatever courage you can muster, utilize that courage in your own defense and in the defense of people around you. Now is the time that we all need to speak if a difference is going to be made.
We do a thing at dinner time sometimes, and it's really funny. And I can't believe I'm going to talk about it here. But when somebody, one of the kids, gets in trouble or they've done something, and we're maybe chatting about the moral implications of what they've done, or we're trying to give a life lesson, and I sometimes will feel like you haven't heard the whole story, or you will feel that I haven't heard the whole story. So if you're not hearing the kids, if you're not hearing their whole story, I know the whole story. I think you're actually wrong, and I think that they're right. They have a valid point. They have a voice. I get up out of my seat and I walk over and I just sit next to them. And then everybody laughs and they're like, ha ha ha, mom's on my side. But you can physically bring your body to another person who is being hurt, and you can stand with them. You can sit with them. And it doesn't mean you have to give a great speech like you give. I feel so awkward with my words because you are such a great orator. I am not.
And yet you use the word orator.
Well, that's because I've been with you for 20 years. But
I think that's a very good point, that it doesn't require great loquacity or great words. It doesn't require great strength. It just requires being there. Stand by them. So I could talk about the systemic injustice in our society all night long. I have very strong feelings about it. I've had a glass of wine. It's only going to get more loquacious from here. So I'm going to cut myself off now, and I'm just going to ask that you take whatever responsibility you can. Look at yourself and look and see where in your heart you're not being a part of the solution, and change that. We all have that ability within us. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. This is Something to Drink About. My name is Alex. I am still a certified sommelier with the Court of Master Sommeliers. They will not take that away from me. I am with the Society of Wine Educators as well, and I will continue to be with them. And I
and
really appreciate your listening.
Feels a little bit better to say tonight.
The world changes, and how we respond to that change is more important than the changes that happen to us.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you. Good job.
Wine tink. All right. Go out there and drink something amazing.
Scotch.